Mr. Hill, Reel 4. We're talking about when you joined 2 Troop, A Squadron, 2nd Fife and 4 Fire Yeomanry, and you were sent out on this foot patrol. Anything else happened while you were out there that night?
Not that night, but the next, very soon after that, we went out as a troop to a village called Voyan, V-E-U-L-U-N. And the Germans were about 2 miles away, I think, in another village. We were in an orchard, which was absolutely deep in apples, the most tasteless apples I've ever tasted. But I remember my troop sergeant was a sergeant general, my troop corporal was a corporal Emer.
Emer.
E-A-N-E-R.
And what were these people like? Just sorry to...
Well, I was going to say... They were very solicitous. They looked after their group. Sergeant Newell, I think, had been through a fair amount. Corporal Emer, I rather lost track with him afterwards because he stayed my corporal for some time, but then ceased to be my corporal. I can't think what happened to him. But in this, I was... the tanks were rather back in the orchard, and I tended to go to the front to see if I could see anything happening. Anyhow, Corporal Emer took me aside and said, "No, you ought not so to talk about the like this because easy enough for them to start shelling or something like that." And it was true, but on the other hand, I always tended to like to know what is going on. But we spent 3 days in this orchard, and I suppose I got to know my men that way.
And what did you think of them as a group?
Well, I had the highest respect for them. They were all efficient. They would always muck in and lend a hand. And they were no problem at all.
Was it a mix? I mean, I know 2 Troop was new.
Yes.
Or, you know, yes. Replacement. But had they created it by just bringing in a load of reinforcements, or had they mixed and matched and put
no,
tanks
they mixed
in?
And matched because, I mean, McKenzie and McDonald were old 5-4 men. Sergeant Newell had been with them for a long time. I think Corporal Ian had been with them for a long time. One of my drivers, I'm pretty sure even then, I think it was Gordon Fiddler, who you may have heard of. Now, I think he was a driver with my troop right from the very beginning, but he never was my driver. Unfortunately, I used to keep a notebook of the truth and things like that. I would have threw it away about 5 years ago. They were wanted again. But otherwise, I know the names of it. I mean, but I cannot remember actually why McDonald ceased to be my driver, for instance, because somebody called Tommy Smith became my driver later on. But of course, people went on leave, they were ill, and there were changes, and. So there was a slight change.
How many, it's a simple thing, how many tanks did you have in your troop?
Well, at that occasion, 3, as far as I know.
Plus yourself?
No. Three tank troop. Sometimes we had 3 tanks in the troop, sometimes we had 4. But I think at that time it was 3. If we had 4, well, it might be 2 sergeants of corporal, just there.
So would Sergeant Newell have command one of them? And
corporal another one. There was always either 2 sergeants or a sergeant or corporal. Or once I had an officer of the sergeant rank.
Now, the other troop commanders, one would be Scott Brownie.
Steve Brownie had ceased to be a troop commander. There was a major who was the commanding officer, 2 captains in the squadron, 2 captains, and then the 4 troop leaders.
Do you remember who any of them were?
Yes. Jimmy Sampson was one of the troop leaders. Tony Porter was another troop leader. Jeff Hales was another troop leader.
And Steele Brownie was by then?
He was the second captain, as it were.
And the other captain?
I think... Then it was Desmond Chute, Chute. I think that's what it was.
And above all that, the commander was... Now, what was Huskisson like?
Well, for reasons which I never understand, he was always called Pinky. It may be because he had a lot of pink face. I don't think it was because he was keen on pink skin. Because he wasn't. He was small, a bit older than we were. How old, I'm not really sure. And he had started out into the captain. As far as I was concerned, he was the epitome of the Scottish leader. He understood the man, he was liked by everybody, he was efficient, and one had confidence in the orders he gave. And as far as we were concerned, it was a black day when he became second in command of the regiment, and he ceased to be a Scottish leader. I always got on well with him, and he got on well with everyone.
Now, what did you have a squadron mess?
I suppose we had a squadron mess, but the way we fed varied very much. When we were out of the line, we did have messes, but when we were in the line, we had either rations on a 14-man pack basis, that's rations for 3 days for one tank.
The compo system, composition.
Well, I don't know whether it was they were full rations, and we far preferred that to the cooks. Cooking. When the cooks were cooking, they came up at night. It was dark, we had to refuel and rearm, and there were lots of things to do. And we much preferred to be able to eat when things were quiet in the day. And of course, in the tent, you have the luxury of being able to carry your own cooker around with you and your own equipment. It's a different matter if you're in an infantry, but it was all there, and we just preferred to eat when there was an opportunity to eat. But rations were very good, and we were never short of food, and we never really complained about the food.
So what did you actually get then?
There were what were known as 14-man packs, which I imagine were sufficient food for a day for the infantry section. As far as we were concerned, we would get a 14-man pack for a tank crew for 3 days. If we have a crew of five, it's one ration short, but it didn't seem to matter very much. And you might, sometimes one was shorter than the crew or something, and so you did a bit better. The ration consisted of 14 cans of food, of meat. The most popular one was undoubtedly bully beef. But then you might have other things of Irish stew was the most unpopular, the colicis, various other rations. And because we had a tank, we could carry everything. We had our own cooker.
What type of cooker?
I think it must be some sort of petrol cooker, because I can't remember, but it was a pressurised cooker, and we could brew up tea or whatever we wanted whenever we had a stop. Usually, of course, in the middle of the day, very often things might be quiet, and that is why bully beef was so popular, because effectively you could have two or three slices of bully beef and biscuits, and things like coleslaw to go with it. Then there were other rations. There was a tin of 50 cigarettes in each pack.
Did you smoke at the time?
I didn't smoke at the time. I had a tank crew that didn't smoke, so we had, I think it was something like 250 cigarettes and I suppose a certain amount was used for trading, but actually it did start smoking very slightly then, simply because they were free and one didn't like to waste anything. In addition, there was always tea and milk and biscuits. I always took a great interest in biscuits because my father was in the War Department and was responsible, amongst other things, for the food, the biscuits in particular, and the 49 packs. And I think he remembered the type of food he got in the First World War, and certainly the biscuits that he produced were always outstanding.
They weren't the sort of dog biscuit type they'd had in the First World War, because they were almost like dog biscuits.
No, they weren't. They were various types. They did vary a bit, but they were, we were all quite satisfied with them.
They were easy to chew.
Really easy to chew, filling. I mean, if you put a slice of bully beef between a couple of biscuits, that would last you for a long time.
Would you heat up the tins of say the stew or the McConaughey's? They're both stew things, aren't they?
Yes.
Would you heat them on the stove or on a billy's?
I suppose what we did was empty them into a mess tin and heat the mess tin. Perhaps we put 3 on for 5 hours or whatever it was, and just have what we felt like at the time.
Now, would you? I mean, you weren't supposed to, I'm sure, but would you use the cooker in the tank, or would you always take it outside the tank? Because
I think we always took it outside the tank, because I suppose if there was great, if we were stuck in a tank for a long time, but normally speaking, if nothing was happening, you could get out of the tank and stretch your legs. So, normally speaking, it would be used outside the tank. Might be used perhaps on the back of the tank or something like that. But we never brewed up in the middle of an action or anything like that.
Now, what about if you didn't have your own food?
If we didn't have our own rations, if we were out of the line, I suppose we got all our meals, the cooks provided them. But
was that as a tank crew or as officers' mess?
Well, that would be as I think that would be as an officers' mess. My memory is rather vague about this, but certainly in the Ardennes, we had the cooks provided the evening meal, a main meal, and we were provided with a breakfast meal, which we had to cook up ourselves. But that was not very satisfactory, because one may well want something to eat in the middle of the day, and the cooks would come up at night, at the end of the day, and when we'd gone into Liga, and then they would dish out all the food there was. And that was, that one just took that as the crew. There's no separate crew for the office. You just took what was going. So I remember we must have had a mess, I remember, when I first joined the squadron, because the squadron had liberated a warehouse in Antwerp, which was full of Cointreau. Yeah, I know we had a bottle of Cointreau a night in the mess for some time. So we must have all eaten together on those occasions.
Was it a hard drinking mess? Because you know the thing, some officers' messes drink and some don't, and some are in between. How would you say the A Squadron mess fitted in?
Hardly drank at all. I mean, if it wasn't for the Cointreau, there was nothing there. We were all very young. I mean, I was 21, Cyril Brownlee was probably 20, Norman Miller might even have been 19 when he came, and certainly people did drink a bit, but it was not a heavy drinking mess.
suppose the officers might have affected Douglas Hutchinson, who was not a heavy drinking man. So it was very, very difficult.
How formal was the mess? I mean, not
quite informal. I can never actually remember a squadron mess. I think a regimental mess. I suppose when there was a regimental mess, it was a matter of turning up to have your meal when you had the opportunity. It might have been no mess now that I remember, but I suppose after the end of the war there must have been less, but I can't remember at all.
I think we'll come back to this question, because there is a separation between squadron and regiment, which I know you want to talk about perhaps later when we...
Yes, yes.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the Shermans. I presume they still had... Cause they were just about to go, weren't they? They were brought out. What did you think of the Sherman tank? And if you could describe it in its basic characteristics.
The Sherman tank, I never actually... thought in the Sherman tank in the sense that went into action in it. It was a comfortable tank, for instance. It was more comfortable to sleep in a Sherman than it was in a Comet. There was bigger space to lie down. And it was a roomy tank. As far as a tank to live in was concerned, I think the Sherman was preferable to a Comet, but the gun all the time was suspect.
In what way?
The 75mm, it hadn't got a high enough muzzle velocity to be an efficient anti-tank weapon. On the other hand, it was a very efficient high explosive weapon. I don't know from a driver's point of view. I suspect it may have been an easier tank to drive than a Comet. And
what were the roles of the crew members? Did you remember? I mean, you'd be a tank commander, wouldn't you?
The role of the crew members are quite simple. There was always a driver, and he was primarily a driver. There was a gunner, who was primarily a gunner. And then there was a wireless operator who was primarily a wireless operator, and who filled in, and is quite important on the troop leader's tank, as commander of the vehicle when the troop leader wasn't there. And of course that happened quite frequently, the troop leader had to go off to orders or anything like that. Then there was a...
Would he also load the gun? Marshal the ammunition?
Yes. The wireless operator did load the gun. There was also the fifth man, who was the hull gunner. He was really a spare man, and you could go into action without him.
Now, by hull gunner, is that the machine gun?
Yes, the machine gun in the sitting beside the driver. There was one on the Sherman, there was one on the Comet, and he was usually what was then the gunner they carried. He was a spare driver, and he was a gunner, but anyone really could take that position if necessary. He really helped. But he really helped drivers make it, and he was cook as well.
Now, what about the role of the commander? Because that's what you were. Could you just sort of describe to us what your job was in the Sherman? I know you didn't go into action, but you know you must have trained.
Well, I don't think the position of a tank commander is any different in a Sherman from that of a Comet. The tank commander's job is to control the tank. He has to, for instance, direct the driver where to go. One has to remember that the whole thing about a tank is effectively a mobile gun, and it's also a mobile machine gun. One sees these days pictures of tanks going along firing, but one would never imagine firing a 75mm or 77mm gun from a moving tank. The great thing was to get into position, either what was known as a hull down position or a turret down position, so that in fact the tank was firing over the brow of a hill. Essentially, what happened was that as you approached the crest of a hill, you would stop the tank in a position where the commander could look over the top of the hill without the tank being seen. And that was probably a turret down position.
Did you differentiate between hull down and turret down in yet?
Yes, one did all the time.
Well, could you just explain it a bit?
Well, if you are hull down, all that is visible is the turret.
The whole of the turret.
The whole of the turret. If you are turret down, nothing is visible except the commander's head. And the ideal position is that to approach the crest of a hill and be in such a position that any enemy beyond the hill are not aware that there is a tank there. On the other hand, if you're going to start firing, you really have to move into what is known as a hull down position, that is with the hull below the ground, because the gunner needs to be able to observe his target through his telescope. One could, in fact, shoot from right down behind the hill with an observer or the tank commander observing where the shots fell, like a field gun, but that is a situation which I never remember.
Well, that would be high explosive, not anti-tank.
Yeah, high explosive, yes.
That's quite. What about turning back to the because I think we'll come upon tactics again. Turning back to the actual tank itself. What about you mentioned the gun? What about the Sherman's, the height of the Sherman, which means its visibility and vulnerability, and the quality of its armor and.
Well, of course, I mean, there's no doubt about it. The armor on the Sherman was very soft steel, and it was not as thick as the armour on the German tanks or on the British tanks. The oddity about the British tanks is that their frontal armour was always vertical. The Sherman at least was at an angle, and if you look at German tanks, that was always at an angle. It was, I think, a weakness of the British armour, that it was vertical, and I believe still is vertical in tanks.
So that's the armour. What about the height? The Sherman's fantastically high, isn't it?
I never thought of it as particularly high. It may be a foot higher than a Comet, but the height didn't matter all that amount. Provided you were tactically using it, if you're in a hull down position or a turret down position. But the problem is, of course, once you come out into the open, height does matter. On the other hand, in the Sherman's favour, it was a fast tank, and it had probably certain advantages that way over the Comet, which I don't think was quite as fast as it.
What about the mechanical reliability? The engine.
Well,
you didn't use it enough to come
up. Again, you'll hear my tank broke down, so it was mechanically, that was a Sherman, it was mechanically unreliable on that occasion. But I think the great thing about the Sherman tank was that it was a reasonably efficient tank, and it's noteworthy that sort of all the recovery vehicles and things like that, when you were built on Sherman chassis, it may be a little plentiful, but I don't think it's much to choose between the tanks about reliability.
Now, what about the Sherman's reputation for flammability, for going up, for catching fire when it was hit or if anything went wrong? Were you aware of that when you joined?
Everybody was aware of that. I was when I joined, but that was the problem. And certainly one of the advantages of the Comet was it turned out that it was not, what one would call these days a flammable tank. I had a tank which a comet which was hit and did blew up. The car, the crew had got out before it was blazing properly. My own tank was hit by a bazooka on occasion, and no sign of it brewing up on that occasion. And I don't remember any comets brewing up, but on the other hand, Sherman certainly had that reputation of brewing up.
And you were aware of it. Did it worry you?
I don't think it did worry me, because I think that one gets worried by these things with experience. I think when you start off, you're much keener and you'll do things which, when you survive for 6 months, you probably think, well, why should I bother to do that? But it never. But as I say, I was in action so little that.
That's true. Now,
one other thing about the job of a tank commander. Remember, I was not only a tank commander, but a troop commander. So I had to control the other tanks and troop. I had to attend order groups, and I was sort of responsible that the troop was working efficiently.
Well,
it did mean that I needed a operator who I could depend on to look after the tank if I was doing something else.
No, I'll come back. What about the role of troop commander then? Can you take those three things and look at them a bit more then, possibly changing the order and looking at the O group first? What was an O group?
An O group was held nearly every morning, it might be held later on as well, where the orders for the day were given out. You were told what the tactical situation was and what it was intended you should do, where you should go, which troops should lead. And then you had to relate that to your own troop.
Now, that would be led by Major Hutchison,
would it? Yeah, led by Major Hutchison.
Would the intelligence officer have a role from next up, or you know?
The intelligence officer was sometimes there. It rather depended, because normally speaking, it was the squadron
O groups, and then there's regiment.
The squadron and you've got the regiment. Usually, you only had one squadron in action at a time. The other two would be a reserve, and very often in that squadron you would only have one or two troops leading. But the important thing was each day you had to get your codes. All the map judgments had to be in code. You had to deal with such questions as when you were going to be refueled, what route one was taking, what it would happen in certain circumstances.
And this would all be told you at the O group?
We were all told at the O group, which might take quite a long time on occasions. And of course, prior to that, the squadron leader has had to go to an O group at regimental headquarters.
And were you allowed to question your orders at the O group? I mean, was it a sort of thing? I mean, obviously not debated, but I mean, could you ask an intelligent question, or were you expected to keep shut, keep quiet?
No, Dick, can ask an intelligent question, because everybody realised that everybody depends on everybody else. And, it may be you didn't like what you were being asked to do, but at least you've asked questions to how you should do it and what you should do in certain circumstances.